It's 4:31 on Monday's Downtown.
Sunshine, go away today. I don't feel much like dancing.
Rich Kimble, Ryan Wayning, Bruce Pratt with you until 6 o'clock tonight. Our next guest on the G&M Family Market phone line is the owner and publisher of Portland Magazine and the author of a wonderful new book entitled The Boston Castrato. Colin Sargent joins us this afternoon. Colin, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Absolutely love the book. What a wonderful read, and what a great job of taking us and transporting us to a time and place and really evoking 1920s Boston in a really special way.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, I've known Bruce a long time, and we used to have conversations about where literature and sports merge. And so to me, this is just an extended conversation about that. And I know from your background at Acadia Rep and in athletics that it's easy for you to see, but I think some people just don't see that maybe the television sports is the Roman Colosseum without walls. And I've been trying to think of some examples just before we even get started talking about the magazine or the book about just simply... Because a title like The Boston Castrato was kind of off-putting. When the BBC called me up and I was in London, they said, it's appalling and fascinating. But I was already in free fall by the time they said, it's appalling. But I realized that there's something about people losing things on a Freudian scale that's appealing in sports. And here's a couple of examples. And you can stop me if I'm way off track. But was the World Series somehow sweeter for us as an audience when they shot close-ups of Curt Schilling's bloody sock?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
And then I was talking with a person who works with me, and he used to be a college quarterback. And I said, tell me an example of... cultural castration in sports. And he said two words, Michael Vick.
Yeah. There you go. Those are very good.
Absolutely. And these days, you know, I would be fine seeing Curt Schilling become a castrato.
Well, that's right. He's in another round, a second or a third round. And that's the depth of a tragedy like that. But also, there are all kinds of cultural castrations. Well, here's one for sports. You're off the bus.
Right, yeah.
But, yeah.
But here's like a stage mother to a daughter in a tutu. You're going to go out there, and you are going to dance man up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very good.
Or there's a mother that's looking kind of askance at her teenage daughter who is overdressed for an event. Aren't you going to be hot in that?
Those are
so
very good.
It is just totally part of the culture, and there's a serio comic, you know, funniness to it. But also there are certain images of cultural castration in sports that I have trouble watching. I have trouble thinking of Bill Buckner, in the '86 World Series, watching the ball dribble right between his legs and behind him forever. And, you know, after the World Series, he came to Maine, and we did a story about it in Portland Magazine. You know, they used to say, where do you go after winning the Olympics or winning the Super Bowl? And they'll say, World Series, and the nadir of that, just the opposite, is if you want to just get clear of the rest of the world and clear up your head and pull yourself together, I think he went to the Norumbega Inn. In Maine for 1 month
to get out of the limelight.
Yeah.
Well, Colin, you know, the thing about this book that is remarkable for me is I've admired everything you've written, from the first short story I read of yours where the guy finds Hemingway's lost suitcase and stories to Museum of Human Beings of your previous novel. But what I want to know is, and I've read a little bit of this, but how did this begin? I mean, I know you were a helicopter pilot in the Navy. I know you've been to Italy. I know you're a man of the world. But what gave you that first spark to get this going, because it's a phenomenally, richly imaginative story.
Well, are you asking when did I start writing? When did I start the Boston Castrato?
Yeah. When you started the Boston Castrato, what was that? What was the spark? What was that first thing that made you say, "I got to start writing this down"?
All right. It's an awfully stuffy answer, but one of my favorite books is Mansfield Park. And Mansfield Park has a heroine named Fanny, F-A-N-N-Y.
Right.
And Fanny is a poor relation who's brought into this splendid, huge mansion, Mansfield Park, and she doesn't have a full footing. It is like being on a sporting event and you're a red shirt player or you're just in the junior varsity. She's pulled into Mansfield Park, and all of the power is taken away from her because she's embarrassed to do the other things the other young people at Mansfield Park take for granted. For instance, when they have amateur theatricals, she participates, but only in a most limited way, even though the reader suspects she has the most interiority of all of them put together. She's the person we're riding with, we're watching, and we're trying on her options. And she also doesn't get to ride horses when all the other young people ride horses. And so she has that stripped away from her. But what Freud, I think, would say, and it's easy to speak for him because he isn't around, What I think he would say is that the clincher is that she stays in a tiny room with a coal furnace that she never dares to light because she doesn't want to use up the valuable coal that her hosts have offered her. And so he would say that she's been culturally castrated.
Right.
In fact, a fireplace is, to Freud, female symbology, and an unlit fireplace is the female sex act unrealized. And yes, it's true. At the end of the book, when everything starts to go well for her and she lands the impossible young gentleman that nobody ever thought she could, she lights that fireplace. and there's a scorching 500-foot flame.
You know, what's really interesting about that, Colin, is that just for people that don't know the story, and not everybody listening will know the story, we have a young street urchin growing up in Naples. He doesn't really have anybody to take care of him. He's got a great voice. And a priest, even though the church has said we're not supposed to do this anymore, castrates him in return and guarantees him a return of life without problem, essentially. That doesn't work out. The priest is defrocked. The boy is sent to the United States. And he ends up meeting every important figure in Boston somehow in the 1920s, and it's never contrived. How much research did you have to do to get that, and you nailed it, to get it that right?
Well, you and I both studied with Dennis Lehane at Stone Coast, and there's nobody, Robert Parker does a great job, but there's nobody who does Tough Guy Boston, and he also does, you know, crazy other Boston, but nobody does it as well as he does. And so I thought, well, one thing I've learned is I'm not going to try to write like Dennis Lehane,
right,
because he's completely realized that. But I thought there was room for a kind of silly Puritan Boston that everybody's even forgotten to hate. It's been so long since they've been sent up. And that is the Boston Brahmins. And they are just ridiculous because everything that they do It's almost like a dress rehearsal for ridiculous things that are happening now.
Right.
They have xenophobia built up into an art form. And one way that's expressed is that they won't eat anything unless it's delivered in a container that's an S.S. Pierce can or an Underwood deviled ham can.
Right.
and that's because they don't want impure influences, like the impure influences of people trying to immigrate into the country, to contaminate their perfect and extremely rigged world of oh, you're not a Mayflower descendant, or oh, you're not one of the Brimmer set, you know. And you don't have to live in Boston to know what those kind of people are like and how how delicious it is to hate them.
Yes, I grew up in Connecticut.
Because we have them here. You know, you've got, I'm sure, you know, we've done stories in Portland Magazine about Yankees fans, and one of the stories was titled, They Live Among Us. And they confess to us their crime, and they tell what it's like to hear other people talking and whether they dare to pitch in and talk about it or not. But I remember I went on this careening anecdote earlier, you know, about Fanny and Mansfield Park. But anyway, I wanted to answer the end of that, like this some debate or something. And that is I wondered, because all even guys want to be Fanny. They want to shape-shift into Fanny and have her reduced set of options as a main character. Why is she so magic? What does she have? And then my big moment for the Boston Castrato was, it's what she doesn't have. Every main character is an incomplete soul that needs one more fix to get it right. And so if I was born lucky and empowered, and I was a six-foot athlete, maybe I wish I were 6'4". But, you know, I had all these lucky advantages. I said, what can I give up in order to speak something that's tell a larger story than just, you know, heroes winning? Because I think that it's on a cosmic level, on an ontological level, we're all looking for a way to be whole. And when you say Raffi goes and meets all these different people, Raffi Peach, in a way, he's the only whole person in a castrated society.
Right.
Absolutely. We're talking with Colin Sargent, author of The Boston Castrato. And, well, as a history guy, I loved the references, and I loved meeting some of those real people and having them interact with the fictional characters. And for you, it was also a chance to flesh out one of your own ancestors as well, at least fictionally.
Oh, right. I'm distantly related to John Singer Sargent. And so, the painter, and he was castrated because he was at the top of the portraiture game, you know, in the 1920s, and then Cubism came and totally unseated him. So, all of these different people lose something with Raffi looking on, and the big thing about Raffi is he never called himself a victim. He made this decision. But, you know, 1922, when this happened, the whole world was turned upside down anyway, because it was the line of demarcation between the Edwardian period and the Victorian period. So between like old-timey and modern life, all the styles were changed. You know, there were something like eight castrati singing in the Sistine choir at that chapel, Sistine Chapel. But the funny thing is, the church said, we're out of the monster business. We don't have anything to do with that anymore. And all of these other people with these strange voices are there because they had it congenitally. Now, when you think of translated over to the sports world, when people talk about having different performance-enhancing drugs, the same kind of equivocal talk is what's funny to me. Another thing that made me start writing in Proust was there was that athlete, because my background's track and field, and there was an athlete running in 2009 who was forced to take gender testing. Caster Semenya.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, she blew by her opponents in the 800-meter race at the World Championships, I think in 2009. She was tested and didn't know anything about what was happening. And then when she realized what they were doing to her, she went into hiding. And the Olympic Committee ended up, you know, just saying she is a woman, but maybe not 100%,
yeah.
Which I can't think of anything so cruel. Although the world, you know, is working on, it's hard work, too, to not be a binary place where things are good or right. bad or male or female. But anyway, she herself would later say that I have been subjected to an unwarranted and invasive scrutiny of the most intimate and private details of my being. Now, that's really bad if it's happening to you, but it's almost like an open door for a writer, because a writer wants to take you into the intimate, private details of someone's being. And I like the idea of someone having something lost and then being on a huge universal passage to trying to get it back.
Colin, it was a wonderful read, and I would say it was also, I found it to be a very cinematic read, and I could certainly see this becoming a movie at some point. Have you had any interest in that from folks who have read it? Because it the way I visualized it in my mind, I mean, I was seeing those streets of Boston in the early 20s.
That's really kind of you. One thing that I like to do is, instead of writing chapter one, chapter two, chapter three, when I'm working on a manuscript, I call it scene one, scene two, scene three, to force myself to drive the dialogue, to have people actually talk to each other, and so that it's just essentially visual. And then I change it back. I'm kind of a strange person in that I would write a movie so that I could turn it into a novel.
Well, you're a good playwright, too.
Oh, thanks. But you know, there are a couple of people looking at it.
Good.
Fantastic. Well, we both love the book. It's a wonderful read. Rafi is such a terrific central character, so compelling. And I don't want to give anything away, but I love the ending, too.
Yeah, me too.
That's awfully kind of you guys. It's a real pleasure talking with you.
Well, thanks, Colin. It's good to talk to you, and I hope I will see you soon, my friend.
Yeah, see you soon. Take care.
Thank you, Colin. Colin Sargent, The Boston Castrato is the book. Check it out. You're going to